We're going to be opening to Genesis chapter 3. We're actually going to be looking primarily at chapters 4 and 5 this morning, but I just want to talk about one thing in chapter 3 as we begin that we didn't get really time to talk about as much as we'd like in our lesson Wednesday night. And before I forget, if you happen to be a guest with us and would like a copy of the lessons we're looking at this morning, just hold up your hand. Gary will get you one of those. Okay. I think we're all good. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15 is the verse I want to look at. We mentioned this Wednesday night, wanted to come back to it for just a minute before we move on. This is, of course, after Adam and Eve have eaten the forbidden fruit, the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God has confronted them about that, and God is, in these verses, pronouncing judgment on the serpent, verse 14, and verse 15, on the woman in verse 16, on Adam in verses 17 to 19. I want to look especially at verse 15, which is part of the curse that is pronounced against the serpent. Remember, are we just talking about a serpent in Genesis 3? All right, Satan is the one who is at work. We looked at several New Testament passages that confirm that it's Satan who is working through the agency of this physical serpent in Genesis chapter 3. And because of that, really what is said in verse 15, I think applies more in the spiritual realm than it does to the idea of snakes. Verse 15 says, speaking to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, you shall bruise him on the heel. I know I asked for a show of hands Wednesday night, how many people like snakes? I think one hand went up, and that was kind of half-hearted. A lot of times we point to verse 15 as a divine explanation for the reason that people just have this innate dislike or fear of snakes. But it's more than that in verse 15. If God is indeed speaking not just to the serpent, but to Satan, the agency behind all of the temptations in chapter 3, then he is saying to him, I'm going to put hatred between your seed and the seed of the woman. And he says, he will bruise you, between you and the woman, between you, your seed and her seed, he will bruise you on the head, or some translations have the word crush, you shall bruise him on the heel. The verb in both of those phrases is actually the same Hebrew verb, but it can be translated a lot of different ways. It has to do with some kind of injury, at least. So what does God mean by this? What kind of enmity is he pointing to that's going to exist, first of all, between Satan and the woman, and then between his seed and her seed? Go ahead, Jane.
From an immediate standpoint, I'm sure she probably is very upset with him for deceiving her.
Sure. Well, yeah, okay, all right. Okay, all right, good. Somebody else? James? Okay, all right. James, in case you didn't hear, James mentioned two important things, really. The idea of Satan being overcome by the seed of woman, and then secondly, the idea of this being as many commentators think, really the very first hint at what God is going to do to provide for man's redemption in the work of Jesus Christ. I realize that the text doesn't say anything explicitly about that, but it hints at it. It hints, and notice this, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed, which, you know, in Genesis, normally when that word seed is used, it's used in the sense of descendants. And it's kind of a very often used as a collective noun to describe in one word all of a person's descendants, even though it's technically a singular noun. Well, think about this for a minute. Who's going to be the seed of the woman, just in the most general terms? Yeah, every human being. Eve is called the mother of all the living just a little bit later. In the most general of terms, her seed is going to be humanity. What about Satan's seed? Oh, we got to think about that a little more. Which may indicate that it's not just humanity in general that is really in view when he's talking about Eve's seed. Think about John chapter 8, Jesus is talking to some of the Jews and talks about them being of their father, the devil. Were they literally fathered by Satan? Is that what he means? That he was their biological father? No, he means that they're adopting his mindset, his philosophy. They're rebelling against God like he did. They're his spiritual descendants. Okay? Uriel, go ahead. Okay, yeah, that's right. One of the things, so it may be that what God has more specifically in mind is there's going to be enmity between those who choose to follow after Satan and those who choose to follow after God, depicted here as the seed of woman in that respect. But probably there's an even more specific sense in which, and James referred to this, that it is ultimately looking forward to a particular descendant or the work that a particular descendant would do. That's the work of Christ, crushing Satan's head, even though he's going to bruise his heel, because obviously we look at Christ enduring suffering in order to accomplish his work, his redemptive work. And yet he crushes the purposes of Satan, and ultimately, we saw this in Revelation, ensures his defeat. And I'll just in the interest of time, I'm going to make a recommendation. If you want to dive way deeper into Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15 and its significance, Martin Pickup, several years ago, wrote a very, very good essay on really on a lot of the things in Genesis chapter 3, but the focus is on this promise in chapter 3 and verse 15. It's in the 2003 Florida College lecture book if you're interested in picking that up. And just, you know, strap on your thinking cap because it's challenging, but it's very informative reading. And Marty makes a lot of good observations. God is saying to the serpent that this woman, remember, this woman whom the serpent deceived, is going to be the instrument of the serpent's own demise through her descendants, especially through a particular descendant. Her unique capacity to bear children is going to enable the birth of seed who will gain victory over the serpent and its offspring. Now, I realize Genesis 3 verse 15 is not real precise in its language as far as speaking to that, but it hints at it. And it's very interesting that this early in human history, God is already speaking about his plan for defeating Satan, even though he doesn't lay it out in detail. This is the beginning of the unfolding of a plan that unfolds more throughout the book of Genesis, and the seed through which that redemption is going to come is narrowed down from Eve's descendants to a particular family of descent that's going to be traced from Seth in chapter 5. We're going to talk about the contrast between Cain's descendants and Seth's descendants as kind of manifesting that difference between the seed of the serpent and the seed of woman spiritually. And then it's going to be narrowed down even further, the family of Noah after the flood, and even further after that with the call of Abraham and the promises God makes to the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and down to Joseph. We see Genesis narrowing the focus of this promise for the rest of the narrative. Uriel, go ahead. Yeah, and that's, you know, if you've thought about that passage in Galatians where Paul says, in the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son, born of woman, born under the law, probably the first thing we think of is a reference to the virgin birth, the miraculous conception of Jesus. There is probably also in that, because Paul by inspiration makes ingenious use of language sometimes, there's probably also in that a reference to this very thought. In Genesis 3 and verse 15. He is the seed of woman that God promised all those eons ago who's going to ultimately bring Satan's defeat. I emphasize that simply because Genesis 3 is not a happy chapter. It's the chapter where sin enters into the world. Adam and Eve lose their perfect fellowship with God. Now they and all their descendants face mortality and hardships that God never intended for them originally. And they have come to know sin and alienation from God spiritually. And right here in verse 15, there's this glimmer of hope that this great enemy who has brought these consequences is going to be defeated. Mark. Yeah, that there is. Even in these early episodes where God is dealing with the sins of men, we're going to see it even with Cain, there is still a degree of mercy that is extended in the judgments that are pronounced. That God is not bound by any requirements to extend, and yet He does. That's a good observation. Mark, go ahead. Yeah, it is. I realize we may have trouble with that, but on reflection, I think that's a good point. Let's talk about chapter 4. Chapter 4 begins, now the man had relations with, literally knew, that's the standard term in especially the earlier chapters of Genesis for sexual relations between husband and wife. Adam, and it, just in that word, it reflects a level of intimacy that is supposed to be in that marriage relationship. Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain, and she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Remember, what had God promised her about childbirth as the result of her sin? Okay, it was going to be painful. It was going to be difficult. And so there is in this, the name Cain denotes acquisition or having gotten something. And so there is an acknowledgement in Eve's statement and in her naming of this child that she has obtained this with God's help. That even though God pronounced that judgment of multiplied pain and difficulty in childbirth, he has seen her safely through it and blessed her with this child. Again, she gave birth, verse 2, to his brother Abel, and we'll talk about the difference between them. Abel, the etymology of the name is a little tough, but it seems to be the Hebrew word that denotes vanity or emptiness. Not vanity in the sense of snobbery, but in the sense of pointlessness. And I don't think necessarily Eve means to say, you know, it's pointless that I've had this child. There are lots of interesting suggestions about why she would name her child this. That, by the way, we're already starting to encounter something that's going to be very, sometimes very interesting, sometimes very important in Genesis, and that is the way people named their children. A lot of us, we pick names for our children because we like the way they sound. And, you know, it's interesting to see how whole generations go through, the names go through certain waves of popularity. In biblical, especially in Genesis, you have people naming their children sometimes after the circumstances in which they were born, sometimes after the hopes or expectations that their parents had for those children in life. So watch for that. Cain we get. Obtained, acquired. I have gotten a man-child by the help of the Lord. Why name Abel something that's akin to the idea of emptiness or vanity? Maybe because and we don't know how much time elapses in a lot of the things we're looking at here in chapter 4. Do remember that. The time scale is not really spelled out for these events. How much older was Cain than Abel? Was there enough of a difference between them that Adam and Eve had already observed serious deficiencies in Cain's character and were disillusioned by that? That's one possibility. Or maybe that the hardships of life outside the garden, the things that God had prophesied, were beginning to sink in, and the emptiness of a lot of pursuits in life, in light of mortality, were starting to sink in, and so Eve gives this name to her child. Or maybe something, it could even be a prophetic statement of this child's untimely death. We just don't know. Something interesting to think about. How are Cain and Abel described? How are they different? According to verse 2. Okay. Cain was a tiller of the ground. He's a farmer. Abel was a keeper of flocks. He's a herdsman, a shepherd. And don't draw from that that one occupation is necessarily more noble or righteous than the other. They just chose two different agrarian professions. That's what there was. There weren't a lot of other occupations to choose from at the time, I would suspect, right? Verse 3 says that it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord, and so did Abel, we read. What was Cain's... They bring this sacrificial offering to God. That raises a question. It actually raises a lot of questions. Where did the concept of worship originate? The concept of presenting an offering to God. Yeah. The most likely conclusion I can reach is that God gave instruction about this to early man. Was this something that Adam and Eve did and taught these children to do? Is this something that's new in Genesis chapter 4? That much we don't know. Were these meant to be thanksgiving offerings or offerings for sin or something else? Well, the text doesn't tell us. But they bring these respective offerings to God. What's Cain's offering?
Fruit of the ground.
Okay. Okay. The fruit of the ground. The produce that he had raised as a farmer. What about Abel's offering? Okay. All right. The firstlings of his flock and their fat portions. All right. And what is the end result? What does the text say in the next verse?
God didn't respect
Cain's offering. Okay. All right. God had regard for or respected, in other words, he accepted the offering that Abel offered, but not Cain's. Does the text explain why?
Because
Okay, all right. Let's look at a couple of, there are a couple of related passages that might help us. One thing we can be confident this is not is God saying, you know what, I like animal sacrifices better. Just, whim or personal favoritism or partiality. Because God does not show partiality in that way. Let's look at Hebrews chapter 11. I think this is actually one of the questions, but I think it helps us get some insight into this event. Can somebody read for us Hebrews? We're looking at Hebrews 11 and read for us verse 4. This is that great hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 4, all these Old Testament heroes of faith. In chapter 11. Hebrews 11, verse 4. Who's got it? Mark, go ahead. All right. According to Hebrews 11 and verse 4, what's the basis on which Abel's sacrifice was more acceptable than Cain, more perfect than Cain's? Okay, faith. According to Hebrews 11 and verse 4, that's the thing that made the difference. So what does that tell us? What did Abel have that Cain didn't? What did Abel exercise that Cain didn't? Faith. All right. Now, that still may leave some details of the question unanswered. How exactly is it that Abel's sacrifice was offered in faith and Cain's was not? Earl? Okay. I think that's a reasonable conclusion. Faith is based on divine testimony. Paul's expression in Romans 10, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the Word of God. That's how it is in Old and New Testaments. It would be hard for Cain to offer this sacrifice in faith unless unless there were some message, some testimony or instruction from God on which that faith was to be based. What is not made clear, and it's subject of a lot of interesting speculation, but at the end of the day, I don't think it matters. What was it that God may have instructed Cain and Abel that Abel had faith to obey and Cain didn't? Was it what was to be offered? Was it the manner in which it was to be offered? Was it the attitude or spirit with which it was to be offered? Was it something else? Don't know. Jane?
Well, again, we don't know specifically. I know a lot of it boils down to the inference that you talked about less than not too long ago. But he tells Cain in verse 7, if you do well, your countenance will be lifted up. If you do not do well, sin's crouching at the door. He was talking to Cain, just Cain was upset that his countenance had fallen. He was just upset because God had
I think that's clear. It is. It is clear from the implications from Abel offering this better sacrifice by faith. And Shane's right. It is also clear from what God says to Cain. It's not, well, Cain, keep on trying. Maybe you'll figure out the magic secret, but I'm not going to tell you. No. Whatever it was, the expectations seem to have been clear. Cain didn't meet them. Abel did. Again, there may be any number of aspects of the offering that specifically Abel did in the way God expected and Cain did not. But in the final analysis, that's it. Abel did and Cain didn't. And Cain is, we'll go ahead and mention this since Shane brought it up. Cain's not happy about the fact that his offering was not accepted. And by the way, there's something else we don't know. How did God manifest the fact that he accepted Abel's offering and not Cain's? We have a lot of Bible examples where God would literally send down fire that would consume the offering that he accepted. Is that what he did on this occasion? Perhaps. He may have may have manifested it in some other way, but it was made clear that God accepted Abel's offering and not Cain's. Cain's not happy about that. And God says to him very clearly, let's go back to Genesis chapter 4, in case you're still in Hebrews. God says to him, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will your countenance not be lifted up? Or another way to translate that might be, will you not be lifted up? Will you not be accepted? If you do well, then you'll be accepted just like, you know, just like your brother was. And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. If I recollect correctly, this is the first time the word sin is used. The concept of sin is addressed as a concept here. And he says, but it's obviously something of which Cain was aware. If you do well, you will be lifted up. If not, sin is crouching at the... You picture this lion that is lurking at the door, ready to spring on somebody who is not prepared. But then he says, look at the end of verse 7. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Cain is facing a choice here. God is reminding him he can continue his course of disobedience. And if he does that, what's going to happen? Sin's going to be master over him. Or he can master it through faith and obedience such as Abel has demonstrated it.
Good. Well, if Cain's offer wasn't accepted, the application from Hebrews 11, where it's a matter of faith or attitude or that type of thing, that's what's taking place here. Then when God says to Cain, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? You can feel good about doing well.
Yeah. And also note this, Cain is angry that his offering was not accepted. Verse 5 says, he became very angry and his countenance fell. This may also be a warning from God that pursuing the dwelling on that anger is going to lead him down a path that he does not want to go. And it does, doesn't it? Verse 8 says that Cain either told or spoke to Abel, his brother. Perhaps Cain spoke to Abel about what God had said to him. There's some kind of conversation that takes place we just don't have the details of. And then it says that it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Why does Cain kill him? The text doesn't say he killed him because of this or because of that. What seems to be going on with Cain, though, from everything we've read? Envy, okay, that'd be a good word. He's still angry. Angry that his brother did well and he did not. Gary? That's a really good point. Yeah. Yeah. In case you didn't hear what Gary said, sometimes as big a problem as our sin may be, the way we react to it afterward and the way we react to being confronted with it or the results of it can be disastrous. And Cain's the first example of that. God confronts him. Well, I'm talking about this before I say that. After Cain murders his brother, So we've got the first faithless act of worship. We've got the first murder all rolled into one event, one man. God confronts Cain, much like he had done Adam and Eve in chapter 3, asking him questions, even though God knows the answers to these questions. These are questions of confrontation. These are questions that are meant to make the person think about what they've done. So God speaks to Cain and says in verse 9, "Where is Abel, your brother?" It's kind of like, Adam, where are you after eating the fruit? "Where is Abel, your brother?" And Cain says, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" You hear the defiance in that answer? Rather than embarrassment and shame and humility, there is a defiant response. "I don't know. Am I responsible for knowing where my brother is all the time?" There's still a tone of anger and ugliness in Cain's response to God. God says, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground." Now, well, talk about what he does in the next few verses. The voice of Abel, that is a very poetic, figurative expression that God uses. The murder of Abel is calling for God to bring justice. The voice of this murdered man's blood is crying out to God from the ground. That's how he expresses it to Cain. Now, I want to go back to Gary's point for a minute. Here Cain has been confronted with his sin, the sin of murder, that grew out of that anger he felt. What is his response? Yeah, he lies. "I don't know where my brother is." He lies and he also speaks to God in a rather defiant way about this. That's the direction it seems God was warning him against going when he spoke to him back in verse 7. But Cain has continued going down that path. The point what Gary was making was sometimes in our reaction either to the consequences of our sin or the negative consequences of our sin, or to being confronted with our sin, we just make things even worse and sometimes harden ourselves in a pattern of behavior that is sinful and make the wrong choice. Yeah. And Cain is the first and one of the best examples of that you find in Scripture. Of course, there are plenty of others. So how does God, what verdict does God decree in Cain's case? What punishment is God going to mete out? Okay, all right. Why is he not going to be a tiller of the ground any longer? Okay, yeah, that's how God puts it. He says the ground that has soaked up the blood of your dead brother is no longer going to yield its produce to you as a tiller of the ground. You're not going to be a successful farmer anymore. And he says to him, when you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength. Verse 12, you will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Instead of being able to dwell in whatever place this family was dwelling and make his living tilling the ground, Cain is now just going to have to wander to and fro, scraping a living in any other way that he can. He's not going to be successful in the lifestyle he has enjoyed up until now. How does Cain feel about that? Verse 14, or verse 13. Okay. My punishment, let me ask you this. What punishment did Cain deserve? Okay. Consistently throughout Scripture, we're going to see this in Genesis 9 after the flood. God decrees that, his decree to Noah was, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Because God made man in his image. Sin, particularly the sin of murder, but any sin, Cain's worthy of death. Is God showing mercy to him? Okay, we mentioned this earlier. Even in meting out punishment in these cases, God is still extending grace to people. He's extending mercy to them. But Cain, again, I think this is just characteristic of his attitude. "Oh, my punishment is greater than I can bear." He said, "You have driven me this day from the face of the ground. And from your face I will be hidden, and I will be a vagrant and wanderer, and whoever finds me will kill me. I don't know specifically why it is that Cain is concerned that anybody he comes across may kill him. It may be just the concept of their wanting to take vengeance for his unjust murder of his brother. And you're going to say, well, wait, who are these people he's talking about? Let's hold that question. We'll talk about that in a minute. All right. How does God provide a solution to that fear of Cain's? Verse 15. Okay, all right. See, there's mercy again. God says, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain. Some translations say put a mark on, appointed a sign for Cain so that no one finding him would slay him. What that was, the Bible does not tell us. But there was something that God did for Cain to let people know when they encountered him that they should not seek to take vengeance on him by killing him. This was God's means of protecting his life, even though Cain doesn't deserve that kind of treatment. Here's God extending mercy to him. Shane, go ahead.
Well, what's interesting, you continue to see Cain's carnal tendencies here. He's not upset, as far as it's hurt, until he gets the ground taken away from him, until he can no longer be a tiller of the ground. Now all of a sudden he's remorseful. Wait a minute. You don't even know if he's remorseful, but now he's upset. When God just talks to him and says, you're going down the wrong path, he could have cared less. And he ends up committing sin after sin, murdering his brother, lying to God, disrespecting God. And God says, okay, now I'm going to punish you by doing this. Now all of a sudden he's, wait a minute, this is more than I can bear. Because now he's lost what he really desired. To Gary's point, I think that's an excellent point, that the only thing that prevents us from being saved by Christ's death upon the cross is us. It's always there. It's when we reject it that it has no power.
Yeah, very good. Very good thoughts. What you have in the rest of chapter 4 is a selective tracing of Cain's lineage. I don't think for a minute that chapter 4 is meant to describe every descendant Cain had, but a specific line of descent, probably because of some of the specific things that are said about them. Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, according to verse 16, settled in the land of Nod, which that... Interestingly, that word means wandering or exile east of Eden. And Cain takes a wife, and then we read about the descendants that Cain has, beginning in verse 17, and that goes down through verse 24. There is an interesting contrast between Cain's descendants as they are traced in chapter 4 and the descendants through Seth that are traced in chapter 5. First of all, we need to look at the very end of chapter 4 because it describes Adam and Eve having another son, verse 25, and this one's name is Seth. You might look up what the word Set means in Hebrew. What's that? Appointed, okay. It's also akin. It is also akin to the word that means seed. And it may be that part of the reason Seth is given this name is a recognition of God's making good, or beginning to unfold His promise to Eve in Genesis 3, verse 15, or promise regarding Eve that He made to the serpent in chapter 3 and verse 15. But Eve specifically says, God has appointed me another offspring in the place of Abel, for Cain killed him. There's that idea of, again, God giving her a replacement for Abel. Two things. In chapter 3, verse 20, Eve is called, in fact, this is the significance of her name, the mother of all the living. And in chapter 5 and verse 4, it mentions the fact that Adam had other sons and daughters. And put that together. Are Cain, Abel, and Seth the only children that Adam and Eve have? No. When did they have these other children? Somewhere between Cain and Abel, somewhere between Abel and Seth, we just don't know. But that helps answer, you know, the perennial question that people like to ask, where did Cain get his wife? That answers that question. Where are these did these people come from that Cain is particularly concerned about, may want to take vengeance on him or for Abel's death? That answers that question. And how long, this is something we're not told, by the way, is how old Cain and Abel were when these events take place. Whether they may have already had children or even grandchildren when these things take place. That's why I said the absence of some of the time frames in Genesis chapter 4. Don't just think that, you know, up until we get to verse 26 of chapter 4, these are the only people on the planet. They're all descended from the same original pair. But you've evidently got a significant population, certainly by the time you get a few generations down to chapter 6. But I said all that to come back to this idea of a contrast. In chapter 4, what is brought before us is the descendants of Cain. And you see a very clear emphasis among them. If anything is said about them, they're pursuing innovation and what we might call technological developments and artistic developments, music, the first nomadic shepherd, nomadic herdsman, the first worker with metal and things like that. You have at the same time a de-emphasis on the spiritual in this family line. Perhaps you see that nowhere better than in Cain's descendant Lamech in verse 23. Beginning in verse, really 19. He's the first one to take two wives in contravention of the way God had set things up originally. And look at the way he speaks to these wives. By the way, Lamech is probably also the first poet, because verses 23 and 24 technically are Hebrew poetry. He says to his wives, Ada and Zillah, listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech, give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. How does that sound to you? Go ahead. Okay, yeah.
All right. I don't know if that's what he's saying or not.
Well, that may not be, it may or may not be specifically what he's getting at, but yeah, this is a man who is proud of violence. He is boastful of his violent tendencies. And man, God said, don't mess with Cain, you really don't mess with Lamech. Do you see that as kind of a magnification of some of the very same tendencies you saw in Cain earlier on? Now, the comparison is chapter 5, the descendants of Seth. Next to nothing is said about their personal accomplishments. But there are, it's mostly just so-and-so lived X number of years and then became the father of so-and-so, and then he lived so many more years, and then he died. By the way, it's a very important emphasis in chapter 5, and he died. Mortality is emphasized repeatedly in chapter 5. Two of the men on this list, Enoch and Noah, it's not actually said about Noah until chapter 6. Two of the men on this list, the defining characteristic of their life that is given in chapter 5, in this text, he walked with God. That is one of the most important contrasts to the descendants of Cain in chapter 4. Not a thing said about any of them
seeking fellowship with God. In fact, it's after Seth's birth that in chapter 4 and verse 26 it says, "Then men began to call on the name of the Lord," which is a characteristic phrase Genesis uses usually to describe worship. And that is descriptive of the kind of people who are Seth's descendants in chapter 5, not Cain's descendants in chapter 4. One of the things you see here is the differentiating of the seed of the serpent and the seed of woman that is evident. And the beginning of the narrowing of the focus of the seed of woman who's going to overcome the serpent. We see that even more starkly when we get to chapter 6, which we'll be talking about Wednesday in the story of Noah. Because by the time you get several generations down to Noah, and the earth is well populated at this time, Noah and his family are the only God-seeking people on earth. Hard as that is to picture. Well, we'll talk about that Wednesday night. But we're kind of just setting the stage for that in this comparison between chapters 4 and 5. Anything else before we finish up? Okay, well, we'll pick up with chapter 6 on Wednesday and talk about the story of Noah.